The Startup to Scale Up Game Plan is brought to you by Alpina Search, Europe's premier talent search firm, dedicated to helping technology startups and scale-ups recruit high-impact executives. Now over to your host, Gary Riemann.
Seth DeHart is a venture partner at Point9. He also advises B2B SaaS startups around the world on building and optimizing their sales engines. So, Seth, welcome to the Startup to Scale Up Game Plan.
Thanks for having me. It's an honor.
Absolutely. An honor to have you. And I'd love to start with an exploration of your journey to becoming a venture partner at Point9 and some of the key lessons you've learned along the way.
Sure. Where shall I begin? Well, I started as an internship in marketing, and I showed up to the job. You know, I had long hair, and I thought my accounting professor told me I should probably wasn't going to make a good accountant. I mean, I guess he was judging by my long hair, but I thought I was a bit more creative. Maybe I'd do marketing. So I got a marketing internship and showed up for the job, and they gave me a phone call script and a list of people to call, no computer. They were invented in those days, but and I didn't get one. They said, call these people and read this script until you've memorized it and get the people interested and schedule the meetings for these guys over here. One guy, I think, was 30. One guy was 90. And let's get started. And I looked at him. I said, this is marketing? He said, yeah, it's called direct marketing. You're directly marketing our product to these prospects and some of them will buy it. I kind of kicked things off. And I think it was, I look back on that as, you know, the SDR function is much more glamorous now, but it's really what it is direct marketing. And then I just kind of slowly moved my way up through different organizations. That was a startup that ended up failing. I joined another startup. That product wasn't very good, but I made the jump from SDR to AE. Then I actually took a step back and went to a big public company down on the MIT campus in Boston. Took a step back into, step forward with the company, but step back and went back to being an SDR. And they told me there would be a fast track to an AE role. I think it was another 2 years there before I really realized that the enterprise AE roles there were not, it's not an easy path from an SDR to an AE. Actually, some of the folks that were doing it had gone into customer success for a few years to gain kind of the wisdom and maturity and product skills to then go over to be an AE. And I was far more impatient and then joined another startup through sticking with one thing for a very long time, probably learning a bit from some catastrophic career decisions. I mean, catastrophic in that in hindsight, I've made some bad decisions, joined some terrible organizations, but I learned a lot through those failures. And then, you know, I was fortunate to get in with a few good startups that scaled up really quickly and lived in Europe in Amsterdam for 6 years and met some European investors. And Point9 asked me to, after I kind of finished up my last VP of sales role, asked me to join as a venture partner and help the portfolio. So now I work mostly with Point9, but I also work with a handful of other investors in Europe and work with Index, for example, and helping them with one of their portfolio companies right now. But it's funny, I meet a lot of really talented people, smarter, probably more hardworking than me, ask how they can be an advisor. And I think it's tough because they made so many good career decisions. They've only seen what excellence looks like, which is excellent. However, I learned a lot from those disasters and I wouldn't advise people to choose bad companies to learn from them, but you learn a lot through those tougher times. So I think that's kind of what helped me be effective. And, you know, I started as an advisor. I thought I knew probably more than I did. But now that I worked with, I don't know, 75 plus companies or so, I have a bigger sample size and more appreciation for the nuance of product market fit, go-to-market strategies, everything that kind of goes into all of that.
And what drove that initial passion for startups? Because it sounds like you threw yourself in to the world of startups right from the start of your career.
I mean, I pause because I'd like to take it as a compliment and say that I was passionate and deliberate in everything I did. But I think it was the company I was working for or had an internship availability ended up being a startup. I didn't even know what that word meant. People weren't really using the word startup. Was 2004 as frequently as we do now. So a lot of the way that we look at the work and the world now and frameworks and kind of categorization of startup and scale up and different series of funding rounds, just that wasn't common knowledge and wasn't discussed in the way that it is now. And so I think what I realized is working for really small companies, and I got a dose of that with the first two, you had more influence. You could meet with the CEO. You had an immediate impact. And I was always entrepreneurial in different business ventures that I'd started before I started working for other people as I grew up. Then when I worked for larger companies, I felt like a small cog in the wheel. And I just naturally gravitated towards that. It was never, I think I got lucky with tech. I think I got lucky with my experience with startups. And I just naturally gravitated to things where I'd have more of an impact and more of a say in things. And yeah, I like to, I guess, have a little control in the outcomes.
Yeah. And you made reference a few moments ago to failure and the lessons you can learn from the mistakes you make or the mistakes you observe. So could you share a specific failure that taught you a really valuable lesson and perhaps influenced your approach to business or to the businesses you're advising?
Yeah. Is this a 5-hour podcast? Oh, my failures. I think one of the things that I think is a really good lesson is my understanding and kind of respect for product market fit. So after I worked for this large public company called Akamai Technologies down in again, on the MIT campus in Cambridge in Boston, we had acquired a competitor called Speedera. They were in India, and I went to India to help train the team there. On the flight back, I met a dental surgeon who was reading a biology book, was sitting next to me. Turns out he's a fascinating man, angel investor who angel invested in this startup, and he recruited me to come over and work for them. And it was the first time I had been recruited. So I think a lot of young people or anybody whose first time they're recruited is quite flattering. You get really excited. Someone finally values my worth, but they're incentivized to do that. In this case, he was incentivized to get a good salesperson at the organization.
So he interviewed you there and then on the plane?
Yeah, it was the flight from India. It was 14, 15, 18 hours. But we struck up a conversation. And he's quite curious. He was reading a biology book because he said he'd forgotten what he learned in high school and wanted to learn about biology again. And we've remained really good friends. And anyway, so he recruited me to go to that company, and I was so flattered, and they were going to pay me a bunch of money and it was going to be great. And when everybody asked me what they did, I couldn't really explain it, but don't worry, it was going to be great. Because I was incredible at booking meetings. I had been doing it for so long. And I knew with enough pipeline, you could sell almost anything unless you don't have product market fit. Nobody wants your product. So we came up with some really incredible ways to create sales discovery calls, and nobody bought our product. And that was, I'd say, maybe probably humiliating, a failure. And I ended up deciding to leave. I think they would have decided that I was going to leave soon anyway, as the company was running out of money and it was just not working. So I joined another company that was in finance, because that company sold to finance. And I thought working with hedge funds and finance would be really fascinating. And I did learn a lot working for these economists out of London they did macro forecasting for banks and hedge funds. And I joined 2 weeks before Lehman collapsed, and I moved down to New York City and I got to see all of that. And I think I learned a lot about asset classes and where venture capital fits in the asset classes that, you know, people allocate their money to as kind of investment strategies. But so I needed a job. I got a job. That was okay. I learned a lot. I thought I wanted to get into finance. That was good. The reason I mentioned this is when the top account executive at Akamai was starting a company, I had been his SDR. He asked if I would join as the first sales rep. And I said, you're starting a company in hotel technology. You've never founded a company. You've never worked in hotels. You're the best salesman I know. I'm sure you could convince me of anything, but I want to hear from customers that this is a good idea. I had been burned up some time and energy and didn't want to be burned again. So I don't know if they still call it that, but I began moonlighting where I would, after work, I would send emails to hotels in New York City, and I scheduled discovery meetings or demos. And I would go to hotels. I'd call in sick from my day job and go to hotels and show them this technology that my friend and mentor wanted me to sell. And it was quite an interesting discovery call, because it was more of a product market fit assessment, because I didn't really need to sell the product. I needed to see if they were willing to buy it. And I would show up, and I still was in finance, so I wore a suit and tie. Later on, the general managers of one hotel said she thought I was her accountant when I showed up dressed like a square. The hoteliers in New York City are quite a bit more hip than I was at the time. And I would show them my screen and show them the product. And at the time, we aggregated online reviews into a dashboard so hotels could see what people were saying about them. And at that point, that was very novel because online reviews were starting to influence the revenue of hotels and people didn't really know why. And it was one bad review about bed bugs, people stopped going to your hotel. And if you weren't aware about it to fix the issue, engage with the customer, you know, and rectify it, all of a sudden people would book across the street. So this was a really novel concept at the idea and people started buying it. And it proved product market fit because before I joined the company, I'd already made a bunch of sales. So it proved to me that I could sell the product. And then obviously that was, I mean, I already knew one of the founders. So the interview was the other one wasn't so hard when I'd already been selling his product for him for free. So I ended up joining that company. I was there for 8 years and that, you know, we raised over 100 million benchmark letter A, and that company was wildly successful and accelerated my career. So maybe two lessons was learn whether the company has product market fit before you either invest or join the company with your time, invest with your money or with your time and money as an employee. And then obviously getting on a rocket ship at the right time with the right skills to help it grow. Obviously, I wouldn't be talking to you right now if it wasn't for that company and that opportunity, but I could have just dove into it, but I assessed the product market fit because I had been burned. And so
I've noticed that you write a lot about product market fit. I know it's one of your mantras, but it's a term thrown around rather aimlessly by people who don't really understand it. So beyond doing what you did, which was discovery calls even before you joined the company, what can a company itself or investors or perhaps potential employees do to figure out if the company they're involved with or looking to get involved with truly has product market fit?
I mean, it really comes down to like the truth. How many happy customers are paying for their product? How many are those customers kind of lifetime value difficult to calculate because they keep buying more and they're expanding at a rate that you don't understand because they're so happy about this? I do due diligence for various investors, mostly for 0.9, but and this is a little bit tougher because you're trying to get out, you know, see the kind of truth through the smoke or the clouds. But the truth is really like economics are on the sales funnel. How many emails do you need to send to get people to engage and be interested in taking a discovery call? How many people are willing to take a discovery call? You know, how many of those discovery calls convert to revenue? How much money are those folks willing to pay? Right. And those are the companies that I work with that I get really excited by when I start to see kind of outside the norms of conversion rates. I work with one company that has automated all the SDR function. They don't use AI, but hyper-personalization based on persona, a really sophisticated engine. And they have over an 8% conversion rate from email sent to meeting booked. That's world-class. There's a huge appetite for that product. And then they're able to convert at a decent rate. I think it's north of 20%, but these are founders who have no sales experience converting customers, maybe being closer to 30%. I think 30% is pretty world-class. But the fact that they can send emails, so many people are willing to take that meeting, that means there's an appetite for the product, right? Then take that meeting, and even if it's not really well done because there's no sales IQ in this organization, they're new to selling, they can still sell it at a good clip. And then as long as you have a large enough addressable market, then you have a really venture, an organization that can really scale with venture capital. But companies like that, it's, you know, how many happy customers do they have? And then going further up the funnel, how quickly can we create new ones? What's the appetite? I've created a few products myself that the conversion rates were just not strong enough for me to want to invest further capital or time into it. There just wasn't an appetite for the product. I could get people paying for it, but it wasn't going to scale and wasn't really worth the time.
What about product market fit across geos? So I come across a lot of companies that are doing really well in their local market. Maybe they've started out somewhere in the Nordics, mm-hmm. doing well in their home country and in the other Nordic territories. The challenge for them is expanding across the rest of Europe and then into the States or maybe into Asia. So do you have any thoughts on establishing whether the business and the product are right for multiple geos rather than just their home and nearby locations?
Well, I think as a first, it's like, what are the expectations from everyone involved? Do you need to go expand outside your geos? You could probably build a really great business that's profitable, right? A lifestyle business within a geo. Like, do we need to expand? This is the first question, right? So I guess if you're planning to raise capital, you want to scale, or venture capital, with the expectation that you're going to scale, you're going to run a competition everywhere, you know, in different countries. It's a tough question because like each product is unique. Each product market fit is unique. And I think each product has to be assessed with whether the product they're offering is technically scalable. Is there like actual technical aspects within the country legally, for example, or the way that the industry is structured that's unique to that country that will make it impossible to scale elsewhere? Also like cultural aspects. Are there things unique to that country where the way they buy or the way they do business is unique to facilitating that type of thing? So maybe it's technical and cultural, and then running into competition. Do you have the capital to really gain a foothold and go into a country? You know, I'd scaled an organization, the company that I was with for 8 years in the hotel tech space. We'd scaled in the US, and then I was responsible for Europe. So we opened an office in Amsterdam and scaled throughout Europe. And some places were much faster than others. And I think Germany was obviously a massive market, but it was very relationship driven, especially in hotels that have been family owned for hundreds, if not thousands of years. So it's like that took a long time to get into that market. So we had to get a really good sales rep. Ideally, we probably should have hired someone with better connections in the industry, but it took a long time. It's finding those early adopters and getting those what we call lighthouse accounts so that the relationship we built there, we could then leverage into other prospects. And I think that it's like, do you have the capital to do that? We should have probably either invested more heavily and been more focused or waited. So I think it's like, which market are you going to next? Do you have the capital to really do it? Coming to the US is like, it's going to be expensive and challenging, and to really get a foothold in the US market, it's hyper competitive. Americans would prefer to buy from Americans. Like most countries are a bit nationalist in the way that they buy. They'd prefer to buy from their home country folks, unless the product is definitely much more valuable. You're going on to somebody else's turf. And so you better be ready to like, you better bring in the resources and have the resources to do it. I know it's a succinct answer, but it's a nebulous challenge.
Continuing this theme of geographic differences, when we last spoke, you mentioned some key differences between the way B2B SaaS businesses, indeed businesses in general, develop their sales functions in Europe versus the States. So I'd love to get your insights into those differences and the implications for a B2B SaaS venture looking to expand into the States or vice versa.
We'll go through the kind of different levels, right? So from like a cultural perspective, Americans are born with the American dream, where sales is not looked at as kind of a dirty word. And I interview a lot of young people and I say, why are you graduating from, let's say, a liberal arts degree at a good college? Why would you get into sales? And they said, well, nobody in my family has any money except for Aunt Susan. She drives a Mercedes and has a big house and she's in sales. So, you know, I'm going to make money in America. It's kind of clearly hardcore capitalist, and sales is very much a meritocracy and you work really hard. Obviously there's some luck involved, but hard work and a little bit of IQ, you stick with it, you can make a lot of money. And so there's that culture where it's encouraged. Like it's very closely linked to entrepreneurial nature of being a hustler, working hard, making more money. It's culturally not only acceptable, but culturally supported as we hold income and wealth as like a, you know, an important aspect of our culture. Anyway, so I think in Europe and other countries, it's not like this at all. Some countries are coming around to it, but some countries, I think, look down on the sales profession. It's like, that's what the dumb people that are blue collar do. And I experienced that firsthand. For me, that was kind of shocking to be like, wow, I've built this entire career that is so positive and supported in the US and in Europe. It's kind of like, in some places by some people, it's kind of spat on in a way that I've never seen in the US. And so if you're a young person looking for a career in the US, your parents would encourage you to go to sales in many cases. In Europe, I think that's probably still rather rare. And I think a lot of young people are breaking free from that because they say, wait, but this is a way to make money, grow my career. I mean, I love sales as a career accelerant. You don't have to stay in sales forever, but like it can accelerate you into different areas. And so I think America has just been selling and doing a really good job selling for generations. I remember one of my first managers said she was selling in the 80s. She was teaching me stuff that people before her had taught. And like, it was just generational knowledge passed down, and Europe's just far behind in that regard. Now it's catching up quickly, but that's a, you know, something where it's just less talent. It's less acceptable. It's less appreciated, certainly in different countries. And so from a cultural standpoint, there's already some of those kind of winds, either headwinds or, you know, winds taking you along and building momentum to having many good salespeople here in America.
So if you're a European CEO or CRO and you're looking to expand into the States, what are the implications in terms of building a team that can be effective in the States, even if you already have effective sales teams and sales processes for Europe?
It's going to be much more expensive. You have to decide where you're going to do it. New York is probably the sexiest place to go. Everybody wants to go there. Many talented salespeople, super expensive. So there's trade-offs of everywhere you're going to go. And then you have time zone issues. Can you do this on the East Coast? Or do you have to be on the West Coast? West Coast time zone differences from London's 8 hours. Mainland Europe, you're looking at 9 hours. That someone's day is ruined taking those meetings either in the morning or the evening. So typically you need to bring someone over from Europe as a cultural ambassador, hopefully someone at the leadership level, often a founder, to set up that sales hub. So it's going to be expensive. You need to bring over some talent. And what I hear from European founders all the time is that Americans are just so much better at selling themselves at than Europeans. Less humble, maybe, good at sales. I don't know, but every salesperson sounds incredible. And so they get duped quite a bit into hiring low-level talent. So you probably want to work with Americans who know how to vet American talent. I was just actually writing about this today. Having someone culturally aware to make those, help with those hires. Also someone who's hired and led salespeople in the past, involved in the hiring process, advisors like myself or these other boutique firms you can work with that can assist with the whole process. That's obviously two important pieces of it. Style of selling is a bit different. I think tactically, it's interesting where I think Americans love discounts. I think value can be inversely correlated in the US. What I mean by that is, as you get that end of month discount, the value goes up when the price goes down and it pushes you into the purchase. Whereas in Europe, it's more directly correlated where if someone's trying to make a decision and then you lower the price, then the value, perceived value in their mind goes down and then they don't buy it. So we use a lot of sales tactics around discounting in the US, which were wildly successful, brought them to Europe. Then my European reps insisted they didn't work. I forced it on them, blew up a bunch of their deals, learned the hard way. Another disaster to learn from. And we just stopped doing that. It doesn't mean not to negotiate, but not leading with discounting as a value driver the way it is. So there's different, like selling in the US and Europe is so similar that it's deceivingly similar, and that it is also different. And these little nuanced things can make a world of difference when it comes to closing business. I think Europeans in general like to chit chat at the beginning, get to know each other, where are you from, a lot of that, and then do business. And I always want, and Americans want to get down to business, and then we can go out for the dinner after we do business to get to know each other. Now that we're doing business, business first, kind of friendship later. And I think that's reversed in Europe, and not always the case. I think Americans are warming up to more, you know, warmth at the beginning, but like, it's an interesting dynamic that like I was spending with some prospects. It was supposed to be an hour meeting. The first hour was coffee, getting to know each other. And the second hour was business. And I'm thinking, we only have an hour here. Let's get to business. And that feels forced and nobody wants to buy from that person. So these little nuanced things and hiring sales reps that have sold in that market. So at least the cultural situation is already kind of rectified or remedied is obviously critical.
And what are your thoughts on AI? Do you think AI can help sales teams and sales managers become more effective? Have you seen any use cases for AI within sales processes?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've seen some companies that are doing AI for testing email copy, right, at scale to kind of personalize things. And some do it well and some do it very poorly. I've received some good ones and some bad ones. Also, summarizing calls. I've seen some companies doing that that are really good. So I think it's just kind of a, if you can use it as a co-pilot to kind of complement different sales reps or different, you know, personality traits or strengths and weaknesses to accelerate things. I mean, for me, it's like the man-machine symbiosis, whether it's AI or not, is really, you want a system that helps facilitate as many human moments as possible. What I mean by that is you want your humans talking to, running discovery calls and using their brain to navigate complex buying situations, the human element, the human interactions. Now, in an ideal world, the systems or the robots would be facilitating that. So, right, you'd be back to back to back to back, just served up the information you need to have those human moments, those human connections, to be a consultant, to do those things, to help sell. And I think anytime that any robots or systems or tools or computers or AI or whatever can help automate and facilitate more of the human connections, I think it's going to help salespeople. But I think each salesperson is different. And I think, you know, you need to not worry about humans being replaced. I think more, I think about it as a co-pilot, just like these other tools are. They're helping facilitate the human connection, the human element.
What advice do you have for founders who are thinking about hiring their first ever sales leader? And also, how about a CEO who's thinking about replacing his or her first ever sales leader? What advice would you give in those two situations?
I have an article called The 9 Worst Sales Mistakes Founders Can Make or Founders Should Avoid. And the headline is, you're going to fire your first sales leader. I wrote that because it pained me to hear it several times from founders who didn't have a teammate and an advisor or an investor or someone else who had hired and managed salespeople previously involved in the interviewing and managing process. And what I mean by that is you shouldn't hire a VP of sales first, but there should be someone on the board, an investor, someone who has a paid advisor, someone who has the time to support a founder who hasn't been a VP of sales before. And you don't need a full-time VP of sales when you're looking to hire your first sales rep and getting them up and running. You don't need one person to manage one person. You have these fractional VPs, or you have I'm an advisor for an hour a week for many founders to do exactly that. We find great people. We hire those great people. We set up systems for them to be successful. And once we get some predictability or repeatability out of them, we start to add more people in to get that predictability. And then we bring in a VP of sales. So typically the VP of sales gets burned because they come in too soon. And a great VP of sales doesn't take a job with a company if it's too soon. So you need to have enough predictability in sales reps being able to have enough pipeline or create enough pipeline to get to their goals, to attract, it's like bait for a great VP of sales. So a great VP of sales, I see them turn down jobs because it's like, nah, there's not enough proof that this is going to be scalable. They make their money on scale, right? Not as an individual contributor. So a great VP of sales is going to make 200 to 400,000 a year or 300 to 400,000 a year. They're not going to get to their half of that being, let's say half of that's variable in commission or bonus or however we structure it. You're not going to get there, but as an individual contributor trying to sell something, even if you could, the time it takes to do all that is wasted with the opportunity cost of a VP of sales trying to figure that out. Just like when I joined that startup that didn't have product market fit, there was an 18 months opportunity cost of me just scheduling hundreds of meetings just to be rejected. It was like, phew, that's really painful. Doesn't leave you a lot of energy to go to the next job ready to do it again. And so you burn energy, you burn time. So a good VP of sales is never going to take that job. So anytime I see a VP of sales doing that, it's like, if you think you got a deal as a founder, you're going to probably fire that person. So a lot of founders are like, yeah, that all sounds good. I don't want to deal with this. I didn't sign up to be a salesperson. I'm going to bring in a VP of sales. We got the capital now. They'll figure it out. But the one you're going to attract is probably not very good unless you're going to give them kind of a founder stake in this, where the risk reward is really, really kind of skewed in their favor. And so hiring the first person, get somebody who's done it before, hired, managed, fired, and have them involved in the interview process at the very least, right? And then ideally you have someone that can help structure a system where they can set them up for success with the founder managing it. previous to that, to attract that good individual contributor sales rep, the founder is to prove that there's product market fit and it has been selling. You can't hand that off to someone to say, "Hey, we built something, now you sell it." If the founder isn't willing to sell, no investment, like that's not a good company. That's tough. I joke with founders all the time. They've gone through PhDs. They're wizards. They're all smarter than me. Now they've become an account executive. And I always joke, there's easier ways to become an account executive than, you know, 2 years, you know, 4 years in university, 2 years for a master's, 2 years for a PhD, working in some like astrophysics lab to start their own company and raise capital and beat all the odds. And now they get to be a salesperson. So founder has to sell first, get someone to help hire that's done it before. Ideally get someone on the team as an advisor part-time, so you don't have to hire someone full-time to help set up that first person for success. And then build up a, you know, enough repeatability with several people that you can then lure in a great VP of sales. And if a VP of sales wants to come sooner than that, they're not actually a VP. Anybody can call themselves a VP of sales, right? You get one founder who hires a salesperson, says, "Yeah, you call yourself a VP of sales." Little known secret, you won't see it on my LinkedIn, but I was the VP of sales of the company that I was recruited by the dental surgeon. They made me VP of sales. The irony is when I walked in a room and they're like, "Oh, if that's the," I was really proud of myself getting paid all this money. If I was the VP of sales, any prospect should run for the door because if I'm the smartest guy and the most senior person, the company is just not very good. So I should have, I mean, again, you learn it with hindsight, but I should have had just account executive, right? Even if I was internally the top sales leader or whatever, you know, I was a reputable account executive. I could have been trusted. But as soon as you see VP of sales from a, I was 23, 24 or something, it was.
So tell me about the conversation you have with a CEO today when they are thinking could be time to replace that sales leader we hired a year ago. They didn't have the value of your guidance a year ago.
Well, that's usually when I'm brought in. They do this. They don't figure it out themselves. Founders are incredible. Part of what makes them successful is making something out of nothing. They're inventors, right? They're really smart. You can figure out sales leadership, all that stuff with enough time. I did. I'm not that smart. Like, you can do it with enough time, but they start to try to reinvent the wheel. They do it their own way. They hire a sales leader and it doesn't work out. So to answer your question, when there's doubt, there's no doubt. Probably should have fired him a while ago. Unless you don't have product market fit, they're not the right person to be, because their only job, if they were brought in with any title, is to sell. So if they're not selling, either they're not good at sales, that they definitely shouldn't be a good, they shouldn't be a VP of sales, or their expectations are misset. They're spending a lot of time interviewing to hire someone else to do the selling. Now the founder has layered multiple people between customer feedback, product market fit, the magic of it all, and themselves and product, it just turns into a mess. So either they were hired on the wrong expectations and they're burning cash to interview other people to hire someone that you could have hired, you know, an individual account individual contributor account executive that you could have hired before burning all the cash on a VP of sales to make that hire, or they're not selling, which means they're not good at sales, which again, like you have a VP of sales that can't sell, like that's not right, or you don't have product market fit. So you don't need that person.
And
now, whether it's product market fit, whether they can't manage, whatever. And then usually, sometimes I'm brought in to mentor that person, unless that person really wants the mentorship and it's their idea, I'm not going to do that because they don't want it. And then my feedback is wasted and now we're wasting time and money and it's irrelevant. It's usually a hard reset.
Uh-huh. We've talked a lot about your career decisions, the things you got right, the things that you perhaps didn't get right, but you learned some valuable lessons.
That's a nice way of framing it. Thank you.
What kind of legacy do you aspire to leave behind? How do you want to be remembered in the world of B2B SaaS?
I don't know if we were going to get philosophical. I don't think I'm helping enough founders. I'd like to help more founders at scale, right? I think the way to do it, right? You're either investing time or money. Money's much more scalable. There's plenty of those folks. I mean, there's a VC on every corner, so that's nice. But that isn't as deep as I'd like. I'd like to be deeper and working closer with founders. The challenge is just how much time do I have? You know, I think as I've been working with these founders, trying to help more at scale and more of a community basis, doing these podcasts, I think that's really the direction I'm thinking. I do roundtables with founders. Yeah, something that's just kind of more supportive on a broader standpoint to be able to help as many founders as possible to really, I don't know, help them fulfill their destinies and dreams. Because for me, that's super rewarding and I get a lot out of it. That's why I'm doing it. They said it couldn't be done when I tried 4 years ago, but I met with a lot of VCs that said that fractional VP of sales or sales advising wasn't going to work. And the irony now is it's like everybody's doing that now and it seems to be quite effective. So what do the investors know?
And to really put you on the spot.
I didn't know we were going to get philosophical. So
the toughest question you're going to get today, the toughest question you're going to get all week. You've got a Hendrix album cover behind you. What's the best song Hendrix ever released?
Oh, Hey Joe, without a doubt. That's my favorite.
It was his first, wasn't it? I think so.
Oh, I don't know if it was his first. When I was a kid, my dad had a bunch of 45s in a box and most of them were very, very bad. But my parents gave me a little Fisher Price record player that was tiny and the sound was so terrible, which is the opposite of what you want from records. But I would go through all the records on Sunday mornings and we would have breakfast and I would play DJ. Maybe I should have been a DJ. Play DJ for them. And most of the music was just not so good. But there was this one Hendrix album that I could just go back and forth, just flipping. Well, it wasn't an album. It was a 45. So it was about two singles. But I just kept flipping it over and over and over. And that got me addicted to Hendrix. And then Hey Joe has been and probably the most covered song as well. Maybe not the most, but there's many other great versions too. But I think the genesis is the Hendrix version.
Good shout. An amazing artist. Well, Seth, it's been great getting to know you a little bit, find out about your quite varied career, a few twists and turns, a lot of startups. And I'd like to wish you and the team at Point Nine with and the whole portfolio huge success in the coming months and years.
Thank you so much. And if anybody wants to reach out to me, you can find me on LinkedIn. And as I mentioned before, I work with many founders beyond Point Nine portfolio. So it's always happy to chat and support the whole community.
This episode of the Startup to Scale Up Game Plan was brought to you by Alpina Search. Head over to www.alpinasearch.com for advice on scaling your technology startup and recruiting high-impact senior talent.